I'm David Martin Davies, and coming up on The Source, the first time driving an electric car can be like having a peek into the future. The EV moves with smooth pep and quiet comfort, but President Trump doesn't want you to have one. Just hours after his second inauguration, Trump signed an executive order that he claimed would end the Biden electric vehicle mandate. But there was no Biden EV mandate. There was an unenforceable target for EV sales. Trump is clearly following through on his campaign pledge to hit the brakes on America's transition to EVs. But can he actually slow down that segue? Wall Street Journal automotive reporter Mike Collias tells us the inside story in the new book, Inevitable. This is a community conversation. We want to hear from you. Call in at 833-877-8255. That's what's coming up on The Source, but first, this news.
Support for TPR comes from Texas Mutual Insurance Company, a workers' comp carrier dedicated to handling claims proactively and a commitment to helping injured employees and workers' comp policyholders get back to business. TexasMutual.com/claims.
Live from the John L. Santico studio in downtown San Antonio, this is The Source from Texas Public Radio. I'm David Martin Davies. Almost 96% of all the new cars sold in January were EVs. That's in Norway, where they're very serious about leaving gas cars behind. Here in the United States, EV sales are still slow. Last year, only about 10% of new vehicles sold were electric. And now with President Trump back in office and vowing to reduce incentives on EV sales, the question is, will EVs find a lane in the United States? In his new book, Wall Street Journal reporter, automotive reporter, Mike Collias says it's inevitable. That's the title of the book, Inevitable Inside the Messy, Unstoppable Transition of Electric Vehicles. And Mike, welcome to The Source.
Hey, David. Thanks for having me on.
So tell me what you say is inevitable with EVs. Is it inevitable that the United States will one day be like Norway is today?
Yeah, I'm going to stop short of that. I think it refers to directionally what we're going to see in terms of the market globally. I think EVs and plug-in hybrids, and we can talk more about what that is, but they grow as a percentage of overall sales in the coming decade or two, and gas engine products decline. It's interesting. We talk about the EV transition. It's actually multiple transitions playing out all over the world at very different speeds, right? You mentioned Norway. I mean, it's obviously completely tipped there. Places like China, close to half the market. Here, we're a laggard at 10%. So, I kind of have to jump back and forth when talking about the U.S. versus some of these other regions and countries. U.S. is 10% today. I think most experts I talk to see it being maybe a quarter to a third by the end of this decade, maybe 40% by 2035. Those guesstimates are down from what they were a couple of years ago when the industry really went all in on EVs in a big way. And the U.S., there was a lot of buzz early. And I think, it's proven, consumers have proven a little more fickle than I think that the companies were hoping. But I think there's a lot of reasons why, despite a lot of the headwinds, and you mentioned the Trump administration, and that's certainly one of them, I think this whole thing stays on a fully electric path.
Our phone lines are open. If you've got a question or a comment about electric vehicles, what's happening with them, with the tariffs, what's happening with the tax incentives right now, if you want to go buy an EV, will you get that tax rebate? Any questions about EVs, give us a call. The number is 833-TPR-TALK, 833-877-8255. So Trump, now he is back in office, and we have a better idea about what he is going to be doing in regards to trying to pull back or claw back with EVs and incentives for that. What does that weaken the inevitability of EVs?
Yeah, I don't think so. I think it slows the pace here for the next few years. I don't think it derails it at all, really. So let's break down what what President Trump could do. I mean, he has expressed some hostility towards EVs. This has obviously become a bit of a political lightning rod, right? You're either form or you're not, much like a lot of things in our society in the last few years. So one thing he's almost certain to do is roll back requirements like EPA requirements, fuel economy rules that the car companies have to hit, which essentially will allow them to sell more gas and diesel engine cars than they would have under the current rules.
So tailpipes will get dirtier.
I think you're going to have, you know, if he rolls back these rules, and there's a process and they've got to go through it, and it's probably, you know, it could play out all this year, or maybe even into next year. But if he does roll back the rules that the car companies have to follow for, you know, the cumulative effect of what they're putting into the air, carbon and other pollutants, yes, that will have an impact on the climate in the near term. It will allow them to sell more gas. And so, I mean, right now, under the Biden administration's rules that were put in place, I think last year, you know, the industry would have had to hit roughly half of the sales would have needed to be electric by early next decade. So really, nobody thinks that's on pace to happen. Like, the consumers just aren't there yet. It's not trending in that direction. So the industry certainly thinks that this needs to be rolled back. It'll be interesting to see how far he rolls it back. But that's almost a certainty, because that's within his realm to do. He can do that, through executive action and through the EPA process. And that's probably going to happen. The other big bucket in this whole EV policy thing from the federal government is a lot of funding, right, that goes in to support the industry. There's a $7,500 tax credit, as I think you referenced. A lot of EV buyers take advantage of that. That's a matter for Congress. The administration can't just take that away. Now, obviously, Republican control in both chambers, I think there's probably plenty of GOP lawmakers that are very eager to dunk on EVs and take that tax credit away. Most experts think it probably goes away at some point. I don't know how soon that would happen. But there's one other big piece of EV policy that I think is really important, and that's this giant bucket of money that's been set aside to help manufacture batteries in the U.S.
Right, because more batteries have to be made in the United States, particularly if they want to qualify for that $7,500 rebate.
That's right. And that's all part of the Inflation Reduction Act that went through a few years ago. And it was really, I mean, it was, you know, there was some pretty smart policy in there. It really, you know, it was kind of this middle ground, rare middle ground these days, where it was like, okay, well, we'll support EVs, but we're really going to, you know, hold the automakers' feet to the fire. And we want American jobs working toward this transition, right?
Right. And these turn out to be like Georgia, Kentucky, you know, right. Illinois, Indiana jobs.
Exactly. So it's, you know, it's, some people are calling it the battery belt, but from Georgia all the way through Tennessee, Kentucky, Ohio, Indiana, you know, red state country, right? There's more than a dozen of these giant battery plants, you know, multi-billion dollar investments, tens of thousands of jobs. You know, a lot of these were started before that money was available. It was just the industry was moving in this direction. But now that money is there and the car companies are having a harder time erasing their losses on EVs, it's been kind of ugly getting this thing up and running. They're really counting on that money to be able to make this thing work. And so are all of these communities, which are mostly rural places that, you know, were sort of down on their luck. The economies were struggling. There's really like this revitalization in these places. So I think the Republican lawmakers in those states and districts are going to have a hard time, even if they never voted for anything that the Biden administration did on climate, and certainly none of them voted for the IRA. I think they're going to be content to look the other way because it's massively benefiting some of their districts.
So it's not going to be so easy for Donald Trump to just make EVs go away. And also, they're becoming more popular, better, more reliable, more efficient, more affordable around the world. We have to compete in a global marketplace. Could the United States be left behind if we don't get serious about the EV transition? We're going to continue our conversation with Mike Collias. He is the Wall Street Journal automotive reporter. He has the inside story on what the executives are saying about all this. We're going to take your calls. Rafael, I'm going to get you on the air when we come back from the break. 833-877-8255. It's The Source. Stay with us.
Support for The Source podcast comes from UT Health San Antonio, South Texas' largest academic research institution, where what is discovered in its labs translates into life-changing patient care. More at groundbreakingresearch.org.
You're listening to The Source on Texas Public Radio. I'm David Martin Davies. With me is Mike Collias. His book is Inevitable, Inside the Messy, Unstoppable Transition to Electric Vehicles. You can call in with your questions and comments about EV. You want to buy an EV or you have some questions about where are we with this transition and infrastructure, 833-877-8255, 833-TPR-TALK. And let's go to Rafael. Rafael, you're on the air.
Thank you for taking my call. My comment is I put a lot of miles for work, and I always have the peace of mind that doesn't matter where I am, rural, urban, in and out, I'll find a gas station, refuel, and keep on going. And I'm ready to purchase an EV vehicle. Biggest hurdle is charging infrastructure. And I'll take my comment off the air.
Good question, Rafael. So range anxiety, it is a real thing, Mike.
Yeah, no, it's really the core question. Two big things that are keeping people on the fence about EVs. One is price, right? They're a little pricier than the comparable gas powered car. And if you're asking someone to buy into an innovation that they're not familiar with, and they're already a little bit leery of that, and then you're asking them to pay more, that's kind of a tough sell. But the second one certainly is, I kind of put it in one big bucket of just charging headaches. You know, where am I going to charge? When will I be able to charge? How long is it going to take? And so Rafael's absolutely right. I think, and everyone's different, right? It depends. You've got to figure out if an EV is going to fit into your everyday setup, right? And it sounds like for Rafael, it would be, you know, if you're driving long distances, you want that backup, peace of mind. There's been a lot of plug-in hybrids that have been introduced into the market. A straight hybrid car is a good way to sort of, you know, get a taste of what electrons can do for your driving habits. I mean, it gives you maybe 30 to 40% better fuel economy. A lot of them feel peppier because of the electric engine, but you don't have to do anything. You don't have to plug it in. It's like the Prius that most people think of from 20 years ago, but they've become so common across, you know, the vehicle lineup in the US. It's not hard to find a hybrid that would suit your needs. And that doesn't require you to change anything at all. A plug-in hybrid will give you 30, 40 miles of straight electric range. So if you're running around town, you're not using any gas at all. A lot of people drive these things for weeks or months at a time and never hit the gas station. But as soon as that charge runs out, you have a backup gas engine, and you know, then you're set. You can stop at your gas station. It works just like a normal internal combustion car. So that's becoming, it's still a very small part of the market, and there's a limited number, to choose from, but they're becoming more popular and more common. And I think it's a pretty good option for a lot of people.
So China is really pushing their transition to electric vehicles hard. Is their motivation about climate change, about maybe just the vulnerability of having to depend on oil imports? Why are they so into EVs?
Yeah, this was actually, for me, one of the most fascinating parts of researching the book. You know, a lot of this, I the U.S. stuff I saw unfold day to day in my day job as a reporter. But China I had been to a couple times, so I didn't really know the sort of origin story with, you know, how it came to be such a juggernaut. And really, you know, the country decided it's a young auto. It's the biggest car market in the world. More vehicles are sold there than anywhere. But it's a very young industry. It only opened up really in the 1990s. And, you know, China invited all these giant global car companies in to start making cars in China for the local market. And GM and Volkswagen, Toyota became huge players in China. And so alongside that, there were Chinese automakers who were trying to compete on, you know, with the big boys. And it was rough. They just, they didn't have the refinement. It wasn't like, you know, these Japanese cars that are, you know, the engines are so excellent and they've got great quality. The early days of the Chinese auto manufacturing was rough. So the government decided, made a calculated bet that we think we can leap ahead in electric cars. And companies like GM and Volkswagen aren't ever going to really embrace this idea because they're tied to internal combustion for their bottom lines. And this was essentially the same bet that Elon Musk was making around the same time, early 2000s, halfway around the world. But, you know, if we go to EVs, we think we can catch these guys sleeping, essentially. And so it was, yes, it was for their economy. It was to get off of dependence on foreign oil. And it was also an environmental crisis over there. And so those three factors really drove the Chinese government to put a massive thumb on the scale in terms of getting the EV industry up and running, you know, huge incentives for consumers to buy electrics, huge incentives for companies to make them, big investment in charging infrastructure. And those sort of seeds were planted, and it took a while, but toward the end of the 2010s, right around 2020 is when, you know, those seeds really began to sprout. And I mean, the speed at which that country has gone from less than 5% EV sales now to close to half, basically in a 5 or 6 year span is, I mean, it's hard to imagine the speed at which that happened. And it's really caught the rest of the players off guard.
Back to the phones, 833-TPR-TALK, 833-877-8255. And Susan, hi, Susan, you're on the air. Go ahead.
Hi, David. Thanks for your show. My question is it's a kind of a comment and a question. It's kind of hard. I feel it's getting harder and harder to know really what the truth is with news. I feel like this is a case where they're kind of gaslighting in order to get public support, because do we really think that President Musk doesn't want electric vehicles? My cousin who bought, he and his son Teslas a couple of years ago, also pointed out that electricity also does contribute to the climate change. Thank you.
Susan, thank you for your call. So Elon Musk, CEO of Tesla, he is a shot caller in the White House. Why isn't he saving EVs from Donald Trump?
Yeah, and let me just first address the question on electricity. For sure, that's true. Like, a lot of times people refer to these electric cars as emissions-free. Not really true at all, right? You've got to plug it in. You're drawing juice from the grid, which for 3/4, I think, of Americans is generated by fossil fuels, natural gas or coal.
Not so much, yes, here in San Antonio. It's pretty clear.
Right. Yeah. It very much depends on where you live. And, you know, if you have renewable sources, you know, in your community, you can sleep a little better at night, you know, feeling like your EV is, you know, putting out less carbon than in other places. But the Elon Musk question is, you know, there's a lot of interesting dynamics here, right? I mean, the CEO of the biggest EV maker on the planet, you know, you would think that he would be in support of electric cars. Obviously, Tesla has benefited greatly from federal support for EVs during its existence over the last 20 years. So this is a bit like with Elon coming out and saying, I don't think there should be any government help for this. You know, the industry should be able to stand on its own. It's a bit like shutting the door behind him kind of thing. I think Musk knows that some of these actions will hurt Tesla in the short to medium term. I mean, you know, plenty of Tesla buyers qualify for that, the $7,500 that you can get off, you know, those battery credits we talked about. If those were to go away, that would certainly impact Tesla. I think it's just kind of a bet that this is going to be harder on his competitors. And it's probably right. I mean, Tesla's solidly profitable now in making EVs, and companies like Ford and GM are losing a lot of money doing so. So, and you know, the last thing to keep in mind with Musk, I really don't think he's looking at Tesla like an electric car company anymore. You know, I think he feels like he's pushed the industry in this direction successfully. And now, you know, electric cars, in his view, are going to be table stakes. You kind of you're going to have to have one in order to do the things that the industry wants to do, which is infuse these cars with a ton of technology. And for Tesla, that means self-driving capability, right? Remote updates. Your car becomes like a rolling smartphone. You know, that transition's already kind of underway, and Tesla's doing that better than anyone. But, you know, he sees the company now more as a robotics AI company, and is probably for that reason much less concerned about the government trying to help things out on the EV side of things.
So I've never taken a horse tranquilizer for fun, so I don't know what's going on inside the head of Elon Musk. But, you know, given the fact that his political behavior has basically caused Tesla sales to hit the skids, but Tesla stock is continuing to rise higher and higher as a meme stock, it seems like he doesn't even see himself as the CEO of an electric car company anymore. He is beyond that, it seems.
Well, he's got his fingers in a lot of pies, right? I mean, you know, most of the shots of the president in the early days after the inauguration, even till now, I mean, he's seems to be omnipresent with the president. Elon Musk is, you know, running several other companies, SpaceX being one of them. I mean, you know, it's amazing to think of what his daily schedule must be like, but
what about the sales of Teslas? I mean, I'm sure you've seen the numbers.
For sure. So it has hit headwinds just like, you know, many of the players who thought that this was going to tip faster than it has. I mean, I think Tesla did. So last year,
haven't the sales fallen off quite a bit, maybe 20-30% the last couple of months?
Yeah, they've declined in the last several months. And these are some of the first year over year declines we've seen in their global sales, like since the company really started. And I think there's a few reasons for that. I think they really benefited from being so early, you know, so much earlier than the rest of the industry, that anyone who's an early adopter of technology wanted an electric car, and that Tesla was kind of the only game in town. And so, you know, that sort of environmental people who buy cars for environmental reasons, or people who are really just interested in the tech or engineering, you know, all those people, you know, kind of gravitated toward Tesla.
You don't think that Elon's behavior
has poisoned the brand? Getting there. Yeah, I'm getting there. We have definitely, there's you see that everywhere, right? Like I saw a bumper sticker the other day that said, I bought my Tesla before Elon went crazy, or something along those lines. I mean, you know, we at the Journal, and just covering the auto industry, have talked to a lot of people who, you know, say that they're selling their Tesla because of this, you know, seemingly pretty like abrupt right turn that Musk has done on politics, and, you know, ingratiating himself with the Trump administration. It's turned off a lot of those loyalists, for sure. And it's going to hurt the company, because they've been one of the most, they've had the best loyalty in the industry for a long time. And it's done damage to the brand. I don't think there's any question about that.
I mean, I used to really admire Elon Musk. I thought he was great. I thought he really wanted to do great things for the planet and for humanity. And I don't know anymore. I would like to know. Had you any insight into like what's his motivation these days?
I mean, I just, you know, early on, if you listen to some of, you know, what he had been saying when he first, I mean, Tesla was founded in 2003, I think. I mean, it's
not by him. He, you know.
Right. Exactly. Yes. You know, I think he'll technically consider himself a co-founder, but he was brought in as a key investor very early on, like within months of the founding. But yeah, technically he was not one of the two people who founded the company. But, you know, he's said all along that, you know, I'm running this company to sort of force this electric vehicle transition onto the rest of the industry. Like, I'm going to have success, and they're going to have to follow me, and I'm doing this for the planet. And, you know, I don't know. I don't know if those are still his strong feelings. I think there's a chance that he does still feel really strongly about that, but he's also got a lot of other interests and a lot of other, you know, certainly from a business standpoint, he's steering the company more toward AI and robotics. I've always thought that he seems to be more into his space company than he has been into Tesla. you know, it's like you can say a lot of things about Musk. I think the guy's got a brilliant mind. It's hard to debate, and it's hard to know when, you know, the wheels are turning that fast, like what's, you know, what's really in his head.
You know, the wheels turning or the wheels coming off? Okay, we're going to
take that's a good question.
We're going to take a break here, continue talking about inevitable inside the messy, unstoppable transition to electric vehicles. Mike Collias is with us. He is the Wall Street Journal automotive reporter. We want to talk more about how the big auto companies are trying to manage this transition. This is The Source on Texas Public Radio. We'll be right back. This is The Source on Texas Public Radio. I'm David Martin Davies. Mike Collias is with us, Wall Street Journal automotive reporter. He has a brand new book out, Inevitable, Inside the Messy, Unstoppable Transition to Electric Vehicles. Let's go to the phones, 833-877-8255. And Chip, you're on the air.
This is kind of a question about the messier aspects of it. Downstream, what happens to the recycling of these vehicles? I've spent most of my life in the automobile industry with salvage yards and trying to rebuild vintage and collectible cars, but I can't imagine what it's going to take to deal with all of the toxics involved in the battery arrays in these vehicles. I'm just curious about if there is the capacity to deal with the downstream effect of these manufacturings. Thank you.
All right, Chip, thank you for that great question. And we are finding out now that apparently these batteries in the early EVs are lasting longer than they first expected. But Mike?
Yeah, it's a great question. I guess the short answer would probably be we don't know yet, although there is an industry of startup companies and bigger companies that have, you know, sprung to life to figure this out. And I think the promising thing about it is that the minerals that go into those batteries, I think there's two possibilities for an EV that reaches the end of its life. One is reuse, just as the battery pack can be reused sometimes in certain situations for things like battery storage. But if it does go to the scrapyard, those minerals can be recycled at a pretty successful rate. And so there's companies who are now, you know, just waiting. The problem is, David, to your point, these EVs have lasted a lot longer than people expected. I think there's this misnomer that it's going to be like your phone. And I know, you know, my phone drives me crazy because the battery doesn't last as long as it should. And within a year, it seems like I can't get through the day. Cars haven't, you know, the EVs have performed way better than what you might think of as a device. So these companies that are waiting for this sort of recycling loop to start are still kind of waiting for more scrap. And so that's kind of slowed the EV recycling industry, which I think there's a lot of investment and capital going into it. And then, you know, to your caller's point, cars have always gone to scrap yards and get picked apart for, you know, every last scrap that they can get. So that's not to say there could, you know, I think there's an open question here as to how much pollution, you know, could be caused if some of the stuff goes into the landfill. But I do know that there's value in these spent batteries.
Right. There's an industry trying to salvage batteries from cars that were totaled and the batteries are still good, using them for household, you know, batteries for, you know, emergencies and things like that, or energy storage. There's a lot happening, a lot of dollars being invested in that area. Let's go to Carlos. And Carlos, you're on there.
Hey, thank you. I just wanted to make a comment. I'm one of those people that was ready to buy a Tesla car, but then true Elon Musk came out, and there's no way I can do business with a person that acts like Elon Musk does. Thank you.
All right, Carlos, I hear you. You know, I actually put down my deposit on a Cybertruck the day they came out with that thing. I said, I don't care that it's ugly. It sounds pretty cool. I asked for my money back because the truck doesn't seem to deliver on the promises. So, Mike, what's going on with the Cybertruck? Is it good? Is it bad? What do you think?
You know, I've not gotten in one yet. I know that they had really strong demand for the Cybertruck early on. I mean, it pretty quickly became the number one selling truck. If I'm pretty sure I have that right. I think it surpassed the Lightning, the Ford Lightning, which, mm-hmm. you know, was a nice launch for Ford. And I think is, you know, it's a pretty good example of what you can do with, you know, there's the capability on these EV trucks aren't what, you know, if you're a hardcore pickup truck owner who needs to haul stuff, I think you're going to want to wait a few years before you think about replacing your gas powered truck with an EV. But, you know, we've heard anecdotally that, you know, sales might be plateauing a bit with the Cybertruck. It's hard to tell. We don't get, you know, a great breakout of the sales from Tesla. You know, I think in general in the industry, when something comes out that's like very different and can be tend to be a little bit of a polarizing design, sometimes they don't stand the test of time in terms of, you know, does the eye just kind of get tired of seeing something on the road? I think time's going to tell on the Cybertruck, but it certainly has attracted, you know, a subset of people who really like don't mind being seen in the center of attention. And it's got like a masculinity thing going on. And so, you know, I think, or at least early on, it's got to be considered a success.
Everything that Elon Musk promised about the Cybertruck turned out not to be true. He said this is going to be the easiest truck to make. It's going to, you know, the prices are all off. Everything's off. The battery power, its ability to navigate in different weather conditions, especially snow. It's a disaster in snow. I mean, it just kind of, you have to, and fixing it after a minor car wreck, sometimes they get totaled for the smallest of things. You got to wonder, is it the Edsel of our era? Let me ask you about, here in San Antonio, we have a Toyota manufacturing plant. Sequoia and the Tundras are made here. About 4,000 jobs count on this Toyota manufacturing plant. It was put here in San Antonio because of our proximity to the Mexico border. We have a lot of parts coming back and forth across the border all the time. And the concern has been what's going to happen to these types of jobs and auto manufacturing if we have these Trump tariffs. Trump did put a pause on the tariffs, but they still are hanging over our heads. What do you see happening with that?
Yeah, I've been talking to a lot of freaked out auto executives over the past few weeks about this. I think, you know, I think the prevailing thought was that this would never happen because it would be so damaging. We sure got close, as you mentioned, about one month reprieve. We'll see. I think, you know, from General Motors on down to the smallest mom and pop part supplier, and there are thousands of them, right, in the U.S., close to 10 million jobs directly employed by the car business. You know, the industry spent 30 years setting up its supply chain and its factory footprint under the assumption of free trade among these three countries. And so, you know, if you pull the rug out from under that overnight, there's no question. I mean, profits at many of these suppliers would be wiped out, you know, in a matter of weeks or months. You know, the profit margins in the car making business are very skinny. There's not a whole lot of places for these added costs from tariffs to go. And so the companies are going to fight about who's sort of left holding the bag, and some of that will get absorbed in terms of lower profits. But ultimately, it's just going to lead to higher prices for the car buying American.
It's been estimated that it could add an extra $3,000 to the cost of a new vehicle. Does that sound right to you?
Yeah, those are the estimates I've seen. A 7% inflation is the best like back of the envelope math I've seen. And the average cost of a car, the average price that someone walks out of the showroom having paid is in the mid 40s now. And so that's roughly $3,000, you know, so there's already an affordability problem in the U.S. car market. You know, ever since COVID, in the pandemic, we've seen, I mean, prices are roughly 30% higher than they were in 2019. That's a massive move, more so than in other sectors. They really haven't come down much. They've eased off a little bit since the vehicle shortage let up maybe 18 months ago. But yeah, I mean, these tariffs are not hitting at a very good time if they're implemented. And, you know, given that, you know, that grim backdrop that I just painted about the pain that it would cause on the industry, you know, this is going to be a big test of whether or not, you know, Trump is willing to like acknowledge the fact that these could be like directly detrimental to the kind of manufacturers that he's saying he wants to prop up, right?
So Toyota did not go big in trying to make EVs. Instead, they bet big on the hybrids, like the Sequoia and the Tundra. They have hybrids here in San Antonio. Were they smarter than everyone else?
I think that the narrative in the past year, ever since, you know, we've seen this slowdown in the U.S. and in Europe in terms of consumer demand and interest in EVs, I think that's been kind of the way it's been portrayed, is Toyota was beaten up for several years for not following the masses, the rest of the big giants in the industry, and declaring all in on EVs. You know, they wanted to take, it's not like they weren't doing anything with electrics. You know, they've had a few electric models, they're investing in it. But I think, you know, in reality, it was their hybrid is their, you know, is their franchise. It's their sweet spot. And they're the most successful hybrid car maker in the world. And I think they rightly saw that the EV transition is not going to be smooth and go up in a straight line. And there's going to be a big market for this in-between area between internal combustion and fully electric. And that's what we've seen play out in the last few years, you know, like a few of your callers, just not people not ready to take that leap. There's gotta be other things in the showroom that give people the ability to use electrons to, you know, get around more efficiently. And, you know, I think Toyota, at least in that part, nailed it. But, you know, if you ask the company today, they'll still say, you know, we've got to get going on electrics because we know we're going to have to compete on the global stage. The rise of China, companies like Tesla, it's not an area that they can ignore.
Right. But in reality, the battery technology that we use is still really in its infancy. And there's new developments to be made, innovations, exciting inventions. I've heard that Toyota has been really working on some incredible stuff. I don't know. We'll have to wait and see. We're going to take a break here. Our phone lines are open. We've got a question or comment about EVs and what's the future of the industry. Why haven't you bought an EV yet? Or if you have, would you ever go back? Give us a call, 833-877-8255, 833-TPR-TALK. The Source continues right after this. Inevitable. Are EVs inevitable? Mike Collias, he is the Wall Street Journal automotive reporter. His new book is Inevitable, Inside the Messy, Unstoppable Transition to Electric Vehicles. This is The Source on Texas Public Radio. What about full self-driving? You know, having robotic cars that can really just, if I could just hop in and I'll tell my car to take me to Las Vegas and I'll wake up tomorrow morning in Las Vegas. Is that inevitable?
I would be less comfortable putting that title on a book about autonomous cars, to be honest with you. I mean, I'm not saying I don't think they can get there eventually. I do think that could be, you know, we may look back, I don't know, 40 years from now and conclude that, you know, this is just such a barbaric thing that, we're allowing tens of thousands of people a year to die in car crashes because we've got autonomous cars now that take us everywhere. And I hope that that's the case. We've seen, you know, false starts from the self-driving car story in the past. I mean, by now, you know, if you had listened to what a lot of the experts were saying in the 20-teens, by now we should have all been getting ferried around in autonomous Ubers. It's just such a tough engineering feat to tackle, right? And there's so many what they call edge or corner cases where, you know, how is the car going to respond to, you know, a police officer directing traffic, or, you know, there's all of that said, it seems like we've seen a bit of a rebound. It's kind of gone away for 5 years. The buzz had faded, and now we're seeing, you know, Waymo, which is owned by Google's parent company, offering rides to paying customers in, you know, in a handful of cities. Tesla says it's prepared to launch a similar service. So
that'll be in Austin in June.
Yeah, I think that's right. Yes. So, you know, I think the technology is certainly, you know, I've been in a number of driverless cars over the years. Every time you get in one, it's better and better. It's smoother. It feels like, you know, a normal good driver is taking you around. You know, the thing I worry about, you know, I cover General Motors for the Journal for a long time, and they had this Cruise was their driverless car operation. And, you know, one incident in San Francisco where a pedestrian was hit, it really wasn't even the car's fault. Like, there was a hit and run, and the pedestrian sort of landed in the way of this autonomous car, and the robot car did what it was supposed to do. It slammed on the brakes, but the pedestrian got caught underneath it. You know, that was enough to basically knock that whole operation off the road. They had to pull all of their cars off the road, and that division never really recovered. And now it's kind of been absorbed back into GM.
So yeah, it comes down to what is our tolerance for risk?
Yes.
If we suddenly came up with like point to point transfer, you know, like Star Trek transporter technology, and we'd say, okay, you could transport anywhere, but hey, one out of every 100,000 or so will turn into oatmeal. You know, would we still use that technology? You know, we have to figure out, okay, we just have to accept a certain amount of risk, because every time I get in my car to drive home from work, you know, I could be turned into oatmeal.
Yeah, it's almost like, you know, Americans are okay with other Americans killing us, but a robot, you know, we're not going to stand for it. I mean, there's a little bit of that going on, and it's, you know, it's really just going to be a societal question, right? I mean, I personally think with it, and this is, you know, sort of a layman's take on it because I don't closely cover the self-driving car story, but, you know, from what I know about how good that technology's gotten, I think if we were all in autonomous cars, it would be a vastly safer driving experience.
Heck, they could talk to each other.
Right. When you mix humans and robots, I think that's where the problem lies. So yeah, I think society getting comfortable with the fact that, and I think this is a lot of what Musk is betting on with the autonomous car, you know, gamble that he's taking. It's, you know, he believes that these are safer than human drivers. And so,
well, Consumer Reports ranks the Tesla full self-driving as number 8th as the best self-driving or auto assist technology that's out there.
It's not even
one of the best ones.
Right. For as much of a leader as Tesla has been on electric cars and the tech inside the car and the updatability, the full self-drive autopilot product has long been seen as lagging some other systems. I think, you know, we'll see. He's applying some AI to that, you know, there may be some secret sauce there. And, you know, the people I've talked to who've driven full self-driving recently say it's, you know, leaps and bounds. So,
and how many people have paid for full self-driving and have never gotten it in a Tesla?
It's an issue. And that's kind of like, you know, it's such a devout following, right? That they'll just kind of put their faith in even though, you know, he's known to miss a lot of deadlines, right?
Yeah. Let's go to Rebecca on the phones. And Rebecca, you're on the air.
Okay. Can you hear me?
Yeah. You sound great.
Okay. Very good. Yeah. I bought a Nissan Leaf in 2020. I absolutely love my Leaf. It's just very easy. I love being able to charge it. I love not having to stop for gas. I love not putting exhaust in the air. But I realized a year or two after I bought it that really the hybrid is more sustainable environmentally, because we do have to harvest components for the battery from countries where human rights aren't the best. So I don't regret buying my Leaf, but I've read that the hybrid is a more sustainable car.
Rebecca, thank you. I also drive a Nissan Leaf, a much older model, one of the first models out there, and it still drives like a charm. And yeah, you would have to pry it out of my cold, dead hands. But what about the minerals, the contamination of the minerals through human human activity, Mike?
Yeah, let's talk about sustainability. So it is true that in the manufacturing of an electric car, there's more carbon emissions that go into the air that are emitted during that process than a normal gas engine car. And that's primarily because of the mining and extraction of those minerals. And yes, there have been you know, human rights violations and child labor, specifically in the cobalt that's been mined from Africa. I think that's been sort of widely reported and investigated. And I know the industry has taken action on that. I'm not saying it's completely cleaned up. I don't really know.
Why people have this argument about that car battery, but they don't have it about their phones.
No, it's a good point. I mean, the issue has been flagged and I know that the industry is working on it and they've taken their lumps over it. On the broader sustainability point, so the EV does roll off the assembly line. It's been worse for the planet than the gas engine car. But obviously, once you put that into operation and start driving it, again, not zero emission because you're getting that electricity from somewhere. But over the lifespan of an EV, it's thought that it's going to be roughly a third less in terms of carbon emissions than a gas-powered car. And I think the idea is that gap grows over time as the grid gets greener and as they find more sustainable ways of mining. And there's all sorts of work going into that, trying to get these minerals out of the ground in a more sustainable way.
And they're talking about, and there's lots of ways to build batteries. And they're talking about using, sodium instead of lithium, which I'm in favor of, so I can say a salt and battery. But, there's lots of technology that's coming down the line.
No, it's true. And, the solid state batteries are kind of considered the holy grail, and there's a ton of investment going on in that. I think that's a long ways off. I think that could be 5 to 10 years. Toyota would argue with me here because Toyota is very much working on solid state batteries. Mm-hmm. But from everything I know and talking to experts, it sounds like it's, a 5 to 10 year, every time you hear about a big breakthrough that's going to drive down the cost of batteries, it just doesn't really seem to pan out quickly at all. It's just this kind of incremental grind that the industry has been on to try to get the costs down in the battery. And it's worked. I mean, the Nissan Leaf in 2010, when it first came out, I'm guessing it was maybe 150 mile range. I'm not sure what the Leaf is today, but I know that a 300 mile range isn't uncommon anymore. And so, they're figuring out the chemistries, they're figuring out more efficient ways of stitching these batteries together. But the cost is still an issue and it's going to be for a while.
So we still, as of right now, today, I can still go out and buy an EV in the United States and get that EV incentive rebate, right?
That's right. Yeah. The $7,500, it depends on which model you're buying. It has to be built in the US. The batteries have to be sourced here. The minerals, and there, you could, sometimes you qualify for a few of those. The car might've been built here and with batteries built here, but the minerals, they couldn't, get across the line. And so it's a $3,500 credit. But yes, that's still in place. That's one of the pieces of the federal legislation that Trump would like to see go away. I do think it's in jeopardy. We'll see. I think it could be a matter of several months before that happens. But it's an important one to drive EV adoption. If it goes away, it's not going to help.
And on the S curve, which is we look at how things are adopted, how quickly a society will take up new technology. I mean, where are you seeing this? Are we at the sweet spot yet, or are we still some ways to go?
Yeah, I think it's kind of, I've heard people describe it as EV winter, right? I mean, there was, and this is, the S curve is a good way of looking at it. It's like there's all this buzz, around the start of this decade with all these new models coming out. And finally, the car companies were really trying to compete with Tesla for the first time. And you had, huge wait lists and people were paying above sticker price. And, now it's super messy. And I think, the two things that are going to drive this adoption higher are getting the price down, which means getting the cost out of the batteries, and charging infrastructure. And so, I arrive at inevitable because I think when you have China at 50% of the market and now starting to pump out exports all over the world to places like Europe and Mexico and other places in Latin America, if you're Ford or GM sitting in Detroit trying to figure out what to do because the demand in the U.S. is less than they expected, you can't just bury your head in the sand. Right.
You got to get in the game. You got to get in the game. Mike Collias, he is the author of Inevitable. This is The Source on Texas Public Radio.
Thank you. This has been The Source on Texas Public Radio. The Source is hosted and produced by David Martin Davies. Technical support by Steve Short, Ruben Garcia, and Yvette Benavides. Dan Katz is TPR's Vice President of News. The Source is made possible with support from the Gladys and Ralph Lazarus Foundation.